characteristics of consecration.
I forgot to turn that on.
Consecration, generally whenever I hear or see that word, I immediately think of other things, and I think of something like dedication or loyalty. Loyalty's kind of disappearing in our culture, but that would be part of consecration, certainly, especially in the religious sense. And then I think about how there are things that we might consider as garnishments for consecration, things like devotion and faithfulness. They kind of enhance the idea of consecration. Now, in Philippians chapter 4, there are several things that illustrate characteristics of consecration, and we'll be looking at those things. Now, I have up here a different text. I've got up there kind of a general text about love the Lord with all your heart, soul, mind. That's the greatest commandment. The second one's like it, love your neighbor as yourself. On these hang all of the law and the prophets. That's good and a good place to start, kind of a general thing. You get into a little more specifics when you move out into the New Testament, especially in some of the letters, do you find a lot of things. And in Philippians chapter 4, you find several characteristics of consecration. Now, we're going to take a look at some of them. And we've already got a preview of what the first one is. That's stability. Stability. Now, this is found in the very first verse in Philippians chapter 4, verse 1. Therefore, my brethren, dearly beloved and longed for, my joy and crown, so stand fast in the Lord, my dearly beloved. Now, he's talking to them in terms of endearment when he refers to them in dearly beloved. They're his joy and they're his crown. But he hopes that they'll be able to stand fast in the Lord. And so that has the overtones of stability to what his desire was, standing fast in the Lord. And when we think about standing fast in the Lord, there's a real need to do that, not only in the first century, but also in today's time. Because there's an ever-present challenge that faces us from the world, like it did back then. And there are a number of things in the New Testament that reminds us of this and actually speak to it. Passages that we are very well familiar with. For example, in 1 John chapter 2, verses 15 and 17, do not love the world. It goes on to say, do not love the world or the things in the world, which indicate that the things of the world and the world in general creates a problem and a challenge to us. Then also in Romans chapter 12, verses 1 and 2, we find there that we're not to conform to the world, but we're actually to be transformed from it. And that this comes about by the renewing of our mind. That's where the transformation process takes place. And that's really where the battlefield is. When you think about the forces of evil against the forces of good, the battlefield is for the mind, to get control of the mind. Once there's been control gained of the mind, then the body's actions follow the mind. So we can understand how this would be important, not to be conformed to the world. Obviously, if you don't love the world or you're not conformed to the world, there's something else. Well, you would be conformed to spiritual things. Things that are beyond the world. And likewise, in James chapter 1 and verse 27, we are to keep ourselves unspotted from the world. Don't let it influence you. Don't let it get close. You know, a person doesn't have to, jump into the mud pit and roll around in there to get muddy. you can stand close enough to get splashed and get a little bit of it. You think that's not too bad, but of course, that would be unacceptable. So don't get close to it. Keep yourself even unspotted from the world. And then another passage in James chapter 4 and verse 4, where he talks about do not become friends with the world. The one who is a friend with the world is at enmity with God, meaning that there is hostility present between God and the one who would be friends with the world. So all of these things are an ever-present challenge to us. Now, they are challenges that need to be met, challenges that need to be overcome. And then, of course, there are other, I guess you could say, destabilizing forces that are present. Some are pretty easy. Ephesians chapter 4 is one of them in verse 14, where he says that we henceforth be no more children, tossed to and fro, carried about with every wind of doctrine by the sleight of men, cunning craftiness, whereby they lie in wait to deceive. There are false doctrines that destabilizes our consecration as well. There are those things that are described as the subtle devices. Not to be ignorant of Satan's devices. He has used subtlety and trickery to deceive many people. Most of the time, I always think about this. I think of it this way. And when it talks about the idea of subtle deception, it's to take something that's wrong and present whatever's wrong as right to convince someone that it's right. If you go back in the Garden of Eden, you see that Eve knew perfectly what she should do in regard to the tree. Shouldn't eat of it. That was wrong. In the day that you do that, God said you'll surely die. And along comes the tempter. And what does he do? He tries to convince her that the wrong thing, eating of the tree, is the right thing to do. And he was successful in it. And that's the way it always is. You think about the number of things that there are, things that are just that are wrong. And most of the time people know that they're wrong. But they become convinced somehow or another into thinking that these are the things that are the right thing to do. And then they do them and find out that that was a mistake. And then there's also, and I've got this up here worded this way for a reason. If you go to Galatians chapter 6 and verse 9. Now this is another well-known passage. I'm not going to pretend that it's not. Let us not be weary in well-doing, for in due season we shall reap if we faint not. If we don't fall back, is the idea. And I think what this is talking about here is the idea of disappointment. You know, disappointment leading to discouragement. That disappointment leads to discouragement. Disappointment and discouragement are different. But disappointment leads to discouragement. We might be disappointed about a number of things. We'll get over it. But when you slide into discouragement, you're just about finished. There's just very little left of whatever it was that you had before when discouragement hits. So discouragement doesn't come all around as often as some people would have you believe that it does. But disappointment, that comes around quite often. There are a number of things that can disappoint us. And yet we have to be what? Well, we have to not be weary in well-doing. Things may disappoint us, but still, we've got to kind of soldier on, and we've got to be standing fast for the Lord and not let these things just knock us completely off of our feet. Now, the last thing is something that's found also in Philippians chapter 1. Philippians chapter 1, verse 27. Only let your conversation You might prefer conduct or manner of life. I think manner of life should be there. Only let your manner of life be as it becometh the gospel of Christ, that whether I come and see you or else be absent, I may hear of your affairs. Watch. That you stand fast. There's that stability. In one spirit, with one mind, striving together for the faith of the gospel. Now, I want us to think about that passage for just a moment. You see, stability is produced through united brethren. Now, that's how it works here. Look at the last part of it. Well, you stand fast in one spirit, that's right, with one mind. Now, each one of us has only got one mind. So what would be the big deal? Well, it's not just talking about us individually here. It's talking about us, yes, standing fast in one spirit, but with one mind, striving, what's the word there then? Together. So there's the unity, having one mind, you being unified in this, and striving together for the faith of the gospel. When you think about that, there's something, you know as well as I do, there's something that's just great in knowing that there's other people who have the same regard toward things as you do, or have the same attitude about certain matters. Or if questioned on things, you find out, well, they would answer the same way that you would answer this. I think sometimes, I always am curious about, sometimes how people react to things that we do when we gather together. I think every place I've been, there's probably been somebody at some point who's come along and decided, well, you know what, it's just the same old prayers and the same old songs and the same old Lord's Supper and the same old sermons and same old Bible study, same old questions, same old answers. And so I think they're tired of it, is what they're saying. Maybe they're even bored. But I wonder to myself, what's the alternative? Is there something new? Most of the things that we discuss are close to 2,000 years old. I marvel sometimes when someone comes along and says, oh, I've found something out new about the teachings of Paul. I was reading that the other day, that this fellow has made apparently quite a good living at this over in England. And I think to myself, what have you discovered that's new? There's nothing new. Now, maybe you're putting a different spin on it or coming up with different things and claiming that's what it is, but it's not really anything new. I think we ought to caution ourselves on this. But there's something about having the idea that when we gather together, there's not going to be anything that's out of the way that's going to be sprung on us or something. Well, that will provide us with a certain amount of stability, of knowing what to expect while we're here, and knowing what's expected of us. All that will contribute to stability. And I think you find that there in Philippians chapter 1, verse 27. I think you found that. You find that in several places in the Philippian letter where Paul is actually praising them for their stability. Well, we move on in Philippians chapter 4 to another passage, and this one is well known, verse 4, rejoice in the Lord always, and again I say rejoice. Talked about that some last Sunday night, not going to go over everything. Want to point out that it says that you're to rejoice in the Lord. That's important. It's not just calling for wholesale rejoicing over just whatever it is. And really, when you think about this, maybe we ought to think of it as something that's optimistic, full of joy, full of hope, that kind of thing. Romans chapter 15 and verse 13 echoes the sentiment when it says, now the God of hope fill you all with joy and peace in believing, that you may abound in hope through the power of the Holy Ghost. So yeah, optimistic and full of hope, full of joy, while someone is rejoicing in the Lord. Now, again, as I said last week, that's not the hand-waving and shouting and jumping up and down and all the other kinds of frenzied activity that some people say is required for rejoicing. Not only does Paul have something to say about that in Romans and Philippians, the Apostle John in 1 John chapter 1 and verse 4 says that these things write we unto you. Now the "we," he's using that editorially. He means himself, of course. "But these things write we unto you, that your joy may be full." What he's putting out in there, that's the purpose for it. To give everybody a sense of joy and rejoicing. And you see that in his letters, all three of the letters there, towards the end of the New Testament. Now, if we go back to Philippians 4 again, we'll find another item here that we might consider. This is in verses 6 and 7, where it says we ought to always be praying. "Be careful for nothing, but in everything by prayer and supplication with thanksgiving let your requests be known unto God. And the peace of God, which passeth all understanding, shall keep your hearts and minds through Christ Jesus." Well, we're supposed to be praying for everything, he says up there. Be careful for nothing. That doesn't mean to go out and live your life recklessly. That's not it. Some translations, I think, have an interesting word there, a different word. Now, some do have the usual word where it would say, "Don't worry about anything," or "Worry about nothing." But some translations have, "Be anxious for nothing." And I think that's probably a really good word when you think about it. When you think about the idea of anxiety, if a person is showing anxiety or if a person is anxious, they're right on edge, you know. They've just got this keen anticipation of something, probably calamitous, about ready to happen, but they're right on edge. That's the idea. And so he's saying there, don't be that way. Don't be that kind of a person who's always on edge and worrying about everything and being anxious about everything. You ever been around someone, you know, who, what is it that we used to call them, a worrywart? Remember that word, that expression? I heard that all my life when I was a little boy growing up. And it was someone that just worried about everything that you could think of. Worried about things that they had no possibility of doing anything about it. But they just worry about it. I've just been worrying all day. I worked one day with a fella. His dad was one of the last World War I veterans in the state of Indiana, which explains, you know, the age of his parents. And he told me one time, he said, "I stopped in to see Ma the other night." She must have been 90, son. "How you doing, Ma?" He said, "That's the first thing I always say when I come in there." And he said, "Her answer is always the same thing. I'm just worried to death." And she would come out with a whole litany of everything that she was worried about. 90 years old, what's she going to do about it? What's she going to change? What's it going to accomplish? Worrying all the time. You know, Jesus said in the Sermon on the Mount, by being anxious, can you make yourself taller? Can you add anything to your life by worrying? No. But sure take a lot out of it. He doesn't say that, but we understand that's the other side of the coin, isn't it? So we should pray for everything. That careful kind of means the idea of anxious. I've got that up there. And I was in Florida now visiting my parents one time. Don't remember when it was. Went over to the church on the boulevard, where I'd usually go when I was down there. And they were studying, I can't remember, I think it was prayer. And this passage came up and they spent some time talking about it. One of the elders was teaching the class. I do remember that. And there was a man over here somewhere to my left who said, a lot of times we've got this backwards. And we ought to be sure not to reverse it. You know, sometimes we pray for nothing and we're anxious about everything.
Well, what does it say there? Well, it says, you know, be anxious for nothing and in everything by prayer.
And I thought to myself, that's probably a pretty fair assessment of things. When something does present it to us and gets us on board in being anxious or worrying about it, one of the things that we'll probably not do is engage in prayer. We're too busy worrying to be bothered with prayer. I thought he had a good valid point, especially when you consider how this is worded and how sometimes it comes out. Also, something that we're probably familiar with, we are to continue in prayer, Romans chapter 12. And verse 12 has rejoicing in hope, patient in tribulation, continuing instant in prayer, always being ready for prayer. That's what that would mean there. And then there's 1 Thessalonians chapter 5, verse 17, to pray without ceasing. It really means, you know, to pray without stopping or making prayer a regular habit. Pray without ceasing. So yes, we ought to always be praying, and we're encouraged to do that. That's part of it there in Philippians chapter 4. If you go back over to Philippians 4 again, now this time, we want to take a look at verse 8. Philippians chapter 4 and verse 8. Now finally, brethren, whatsoever things are true, whatsoever things are honest, whatsoever things are just, whatsoever things are pure, whatsoever things are lovely, whatsoever things are of good report, if there be any virtue, and if there be any praise, think on these things. Now that's quite a listing of good things, no doubt about it, that we might concentrate on and think about these things rather than perhaps a number of other things that we might dwell upon, those things back up in verse 6 that we might be anxious about, but these things can replace that, you see. But look at verse 8 at the last there, where he says, think on these things. I looked at that and I thought to myself, that's talking actually about controlled thought. Controlled thought. You think about it. Yeah, that's what it is. And really the wording there when he says, you know, think on these things, he's telling them that this can be done. We generally can have control of our thoughts. Or, as we say, we can lose control of our thoughts. Well, it can work either way. We know that that is entirely possible. And as I said earlier, because, you know, the mind is the battleground, this idea of controlling thoughts is something that's very important. Back in the Old Testament book of Proverbs, it speaks about how important our thinking or our thoughts are. For example, in Proverbs chapter 4 and verse 23, keep thy heart with all diligence, for out of it are the issues of life. Now, we understand that the Bible heart's referring to the inner man, to the conscience of man, to the thoughts of man, to the mind of man. And then a passage like this is found in Proverbs chapter 23. Verse 7. For as he thinketh in his heart, so is he. Eat and drink, saith he to thee, but his heart is not with thee. So yes, our thoughts are the basis of the life that we live. As we think, so we are. Our thoughts shape our actions. Of course they do. Now, if we realize that, then we can understand how important it is then to have controlled thoughts and to be the one who steers our thinking in the right direction, where we won't be spending all of our time thinking about and dwelling on things we've got no control over, but actually thinking about things that do matter and things that we can do, things that we've, you know, we can possibly affect. and go that way. So we concentrate on the good things, you see. Think on these things. So control your thought and get your thoughts centered on the right way. I like to think of it that if we can drive certain thoughts out, controlling our thoughts, drive these things out. Now, they're going to have to be replaced. That's just the way it is. Or if we don't replace those thoughts with something else, then it'll all get just, you know, pulled back in. There are times whenever of a night that perhaps you've experienced this where it's difficult to hit the off switch here. It's just hard to do. There are things that you're concerned about. And you realize that if those things, whatever it is, I mean, it could just be the dentist appointment tomorrow. Doesn't matter. You know that that's got control of things on there. That's like the hamster on the wheel that just keeps going. And you can't get it to stop. You can't do it. The only way this is going to work is to replace that with something else. That'll shut down the other business. Get you to refocus, realign, and things can calm down. And perhaps then you can go to sleep. Well, it's that way in life too. There's a lot of things that concern us, perhaps all the time. One of the things that happens in cases that lead to just serious consequences is an expression that's used a whole lot, and it's not very accurate expression. I've been going up to rehab center on Thursday nights, visiting a man up there, having Bible study with him. He doesn't get any visitors. He's from West Virginia, doesn't get any visitors. So I've been going up there, and it's not like the Bible study is going to convert him or anything like that. He already is, and he's very knowledgeable of the Scriptures. But it's something that we've got to talk about and do while I'm there for an hour or so. He's been moved, by the way, to another place, another building. And he was originally in a car wreck and paralyzed from the neck down. He's regained some use of his hands and arms things. But when it first happened, he couldn't move at all. He couldn't even sit up. Nothing. And I waited until last time I saw him. Saw him last week, time before last. And it wasn't until then I actually asked him about the wreck and what happened. You know, I've got in mind it was something perhaps horrific. And he said, I was looking out the window. I was in some traffic. And I was looking out the window off to the right. And the car in front of me, I guess, had decided to turn, so it had stopped. I didn't see the turn signal come on. And I tapped the bumper. And that's all it took. There wasn't even any damage to either car. Just to him. He got the whiplash effect. And he had a problem in one of the discs in his vertebrae. And that's what caused the spinal column to collapse onto the spine, like squeezing it like that, like taking a tube of biscuits and squeezing it and then let go. Still there. It's not like it was. And he said, I just wasn't paying attention. I just wasn't thinking. I was distracted. Your thoughts were elsewhere. See? That's really what he's saying, isn't it? Yeah. And look what happened. And so, you know, something can happen when we just let our thoughts be distracted. And a lot of times, you know, they're distracted through the day.
Oh, how did you manage to cut your finger off there on that saw? Well, I was thinking about going fishing tonight. Oh. You get the idea? So we need to control our thoughts. It's something that is, after all, important. Another thing, Philippians chapter 4, you go back over there. And let's look at contentment. Philippians chapter 4, verses 11 and 12. Not that I speak in respect of want, for I have learned in whatever state I am, therewith to be content. I know both how to be abased, I know how to abound. Everywhere and in all things I am instructed both to be full and to be hungry, both to abound and to suffer need. Now, Paul says there that he had learned this. So apparently it's not something that comes along naturally. It's something that you learn. And of course, there's a difference between what you want and what you need. Apparently, Paul had everything that he needed. But now in respect of want, well, I'm just pretty well content. Whatever it is, this is all right. This is good enough. And I think that's something that, you know, is a factor to be learned, an attitude to be learned. Whatever state I am, I'm content. When Paul wrote this letter, it would have been at the time when he would have been in Rome and would have been a prisoner. Not the best place to be, making an appeal to Caesar. There wasn't any appeal after Caesar. If Caesar decided, you know, more or less the old thumbs up or thumbs down, there wasn't anybody else to go to. So you could say, well, he was in kind of a tight spot, and you'd be right. But no matter what it was, I'm content with this. After all, he says that, well, I may be in chains, but you know what? I've got a certain amount of freedom. People can come and see me, and I can talk to them. And you find in Philippians, he was even successful in converting some of Caesar's household, some who were in the palace. Perhaps it was servants, maybe it was officers. I don't know. It doesn't go through a list of people, but he said he'd have some success there. He was content with wherever he was. That's something to be learned. How did he manage to do that? I'll have to admit, that might not be the kind of a situation where I would say, well, I'm content with this. Think of him being in that jail in Philippi. Prior to this, that's not a very good place to be content either, but there he and Silas were in the jail, singing songs and praying to God. Philippians chapter 1, verse 21 may offer us a clue on this, where Paul says, "For to me to live is Christ, and to die is gain." Well, he was living a Christ-centered life, so he could be content. I think one of the great challenges we have today now, when we talk about a centered life and have a blank up there, what ought to go in that? Too many times people want to put in there a me-centered life. Talked about that a couple weeks ago. A me-centered life. And, well, if we've got that, and that really is, that's the thing of the world today. Whatever you want to say, that's just eating us up. All this stuff that goes on of everybody. I saw a picture. Maybe somebody else saw this too. I saw a picture, and just a little picture like a snapshot. And up at the top it said 2015, and underneath it said the year everyone was offended. Have you noticed that? Anymore, it doesn't matter what it. I'm offended by that. I can stand out here in the front yard and clip my fingernails, and somebody may drive by and they're offended by that. Everybody's offended by everything. It doesn't matter what it is. If it goes long enough and enough people, somebody's going to be offended over it. And everybody's got to bow and scrape to those who are offended over everything. Why is this going on? Because it's all about me. It's all about me. That's what the whole thing is. Everybody's offended. It's all about me. And it's an effort, I think, sometimes
to elevate oneself to a certain prominence, importance, and other things along that line. How does that work in any kind of relationship? Whenever it becomes all about me. Well, it's pretty well a disaster. It's a disaster when it comes to something like friendship. It's a disaster when it comes to any kind of teamwork, if it's at work or if it's in sports or anything like that. It's just pretty well going to be a disaster when it's all about me. I'm not interested in the team winning as long as I had a good game, as long as I looked good. I don't care about anybody else. You get the idea. Marriage relationship, when it's all about me, marriage is in trouble. But we live a Christ-centered life. That's what Paul did. That's how he could be content. And also, he says that it was a Christ-controlled life. I've been crucified with Christ. Nevertheless, it's not me that lives, but it's Christ who lives. And Christ controlled his life. And you can see that just over the broad scale of everything and all the letters that he wrote. Paul was someone who was content. We really do need to learn contentment. I really think that's something that's important. Now, the last thing is in Philippians chapter 4, verse 16, 17. The church in Philippi was one of the first, apparently, that helped Paul. I really think that they may have helped him while he was in Corinth. You look on a map, Corinth isn't that very far away. They would be familiar. They could get it there to him, and it may have happened there. I'm not saying that it did, but I think that's the likelihood of what he's talking about here. He says, even in Thessalonica, you sent once and again unto my necessity. So there you go. They helped him in Thessalonica. He moves on. They help him other places. Sure. Corinth, why not? Not because I desire a gift, but I desire fruit that may abound to your account. Now what we want to see there, take away from that, is we're supposed to produce fruit. This, he says, is held to your account. Well, now what is it that's held to your account? I desire fruit that may abound to your account. The fruit that you produce goes on your account, if you will. It means something to produce fruit. It means something to add to your faith, virtue, to virtue knowledge, other things like that. It means something to be involved with the fruit of the Spirit, love, joy, peace, etc., long-suffering, and so on. All this, adding fruit to your account. And also then what you can do to help others, like they did with Paul. That's all to your account. And also, Jesus said this, John chapter 15, verses 1 through 8. He says, I am the true vine, and my Father is the husbandman. Every branch in me that beareth not fruit, he taketh away, and every branch that beareth fruit, he purgeth it, that it may bring forth more fruit. Now you are clean through the word which I have spoken unto you. Abide in me, and I in you. As the branch cannot bear fruit of itself, except it abide in the vine, no more can you, except you abide in me. I am the vine, you are the branches. He that abideth in me, and I in him, the same bringeth forth much fruit. For without me, you can do nothing. If a man abide not in me, he is cast forth as a branch, and is withered, and men gather them, and cast them into the fire, and they are burned. If you abide in me, and my words abide in you, you shall ask whatever you will, and it shall be done unto you. Okay, we see what he's talking about, bearing fruit, not bearing fruit, all that. Now look at verse 8. Herein is my Father glorified. Oh, all right. That you bear much fruit, so shall you be my disciples. God's glorified by a fruitful life. Now that's what he's ultimately saying there. We see what it is to bear fruit. You've got to abide in Jesus to bear fruit. Some branches aren't really connected to the vine. They're not bearing fruit. You know, the idea of them being cut off and they wither. They've just been over there and kind of just, you know, taking nourishment in one thing or another and producing nothing. On a fruit tree,
that's supposed to fruit produce fruit no matter what it is. There will be things that will spring off of the branches. And they're part of the tree. Sure they are. They're growing right out of it. But they don't produce anything. We call those suckers. They're just sucking the life out of the tree and they're not producing anything. They're cut off. They're cut off and then they're collected. And what happens to them after they cut off? Well, they wither. They dry up. And then they're burnt. But they're cut off so that the other rest of the tree can produce. That's part of the work of the husbandman. That's part of the purging that Jesus talks about. Also, the Father can be glorified and be glorified the best. So when we're producing fruit, we're not doing it for ourselves and we're not doing it, you know, to elevate ourselves or put us in some place of prominence. We're doing this in order to glorify God. He's glorified by a fruitful life. Now take your songbooks and turn to the song that's been selected. I think really all these need to be considered and put into practice in order that we can fulfill the words over in Philippians chapter 2, verse 15, that you be blameless and harmless, the sons of God, without rebuke in the midst of a crooked and perverse nation, among whom you shine as lights in the world. Our light shines whenever we obey the gospel, and when we conduct ourselves as Christians, when we are consecrated, and when we have the characteristics of consecration. The lesson is yours. If there would be one tonight that would like to obey the gospel, we'd be happy to help you to do that. If you need to make correction, we can help you with that as well. Whatever the case is, if you're subject to the invitation, now's the time. Please come all together. We stand and sing.